From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young at the DNC in Philadelphia. It's Here and Now.
We need leadership which brings our people together and makes us stronger. By these measures, any objective observer will conclude that based on her ideas and her leadership, Hillary Clinton must become the next president of the United States.
That, of course, Bernie Sanders closing the opening night of the Democratic Convention, which will culminate in the nomination of his former rival, Hillary Clinton. It was a remarkably unified ending to an evening that seemed at times like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Grief. There was anger, booze, there was denial, there was depression. Someone tweeted out, it's like Bernie is breaking up with 100,000 people. But will there be the last stage, acceptance? And how about First Lady Michelle Obama? Maybe the speech of the week when it's all over. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here in Philly. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin. That was a perfect introduction.
Oh, well, there you go. And it seemed, though, like a scene change, didn't it? Actually, from Sunday when hacked emails revealed the DNC undermined Sanders' campaign to the end of last night, you know, almost acceptance. What do you think?
If you were watching on television or if you were in the hall and could focus entirely on the stage, yes, you saw an enormous sea change in which over the course of the evening, the hostility of some of the people who felt wronged by those DNC emails was incorporated into the larger energy of people being joyful about the Democratic Party and about Hillary Clinton and about Bernie Sanders and about everybody else who was on stage, including the musicians, you know, Paul Simon and so on, Boys to Men. And it was a happy sort of an event. But if you were down in the rows, particularly of the California delegation and some of the other delegations that had a lot of really committed, hardcore Bernie Sanders supporters, they were upset with Bernie Sanders. They were upset with Sarah Silverman, the comedian and entertainer who got on stage and told them, hey, Bernie, you know, Bernie or bust people, you're being ridiculous. And they were upset with a lot of the people who wanted to essentially, as you say, accept, capitulate, and become part of the Democratic Party. They don't feel part of that party.
Yeah. Well, we are also hearing out on the streets. I mean, you were hearing it down on the floor. We're hearing it out on the streets today. There's definitely, you know, still that part of the Bernie Sanders contingent that's saying, the heck with him, he can go to Hillary, but we're not. It's kind of interesting. But some people, Ron, might also say that the other thing that happened last night, Michelle Obama happened. Let's listen.
So, don't let anyone ever tell you that this country isn't great, that somehow we need to make it great again, because this right now is the greatest country on earth.
Ron Elving, do you think she, I mean, how did you see her impact on maybe even the Bernie supporters?
You know, Democrats have gotten used to having the best speech, most moving speech at their conventions given by someone named Obama. But this year, that person is also named Michelle. I don't know what the president may say on Wednesday night, but the speech that she gave on Monday night was not only deeply moving for many of the people present, but I think it would be hard for anyone to have watched it and not feel as though there was a tremendous amount of herself in that speech, talking about raising her daughters in the White House, a building built by slaves, and now having the opportunity for those two daughters to see the first woman nominated for president. And that was pretty powerful stuff in this hall.
Yeah, well, you're reminding us that the Democrats not only have to reach out to Bernie supporters, but to African-Americans, members of the Black Lives Movement. What, in your mind, did the Dems have to get across, and did they?
They have much to get across, and they did not get to all of it. They did not address many of the attacks that were made at the Republican convention last week. They did not talk a lot about international terrorism. They did not go to the dark side or try to deal with many of those issues. They also have much to reconcile between the past, the present, and the future, which is obviously a big challenge for anyone. But the Sanders movement is largely about the present and the conditions of the present and where the country goes from here. Much of this convention is organized around a celebration and a remembrance of the past. For example, Hillary Clinton's name tonight is going to be put in nomination by Barbara Mikulski, the woman senator who's retiring this year and has served longer than any other woman in the Senate, and John Lewis, who is, of course, the icon of the civil rights movement. They are both about where women and minorities have come from and come to in this country. And that's not what a lot of the younger Sanders people want to talk about.
Right. Well, speaking of past versus present, President Clinton, Bill Clinton, is the headliner tonight. And we remember that in 1996, and Hillary spoke in support of him, and she closed her speech. You know, she talked about the American children. You know, Ron, your thoughts about this? Now we have him speaking of her.
Yes, that was 20 years ago in Chicago. She gave a It Takes a Village speech based on that book title that she had. And then she said, and you know, it takes a president to get these things done. She was then, of course, talking about her husband. But there were those, even in 1996, who kind of nudged each other and pointed up at Hillary Clinton and said, maybe someday she'll be that president it takes to get these things done.
Well, and just real quick, Ron, sometimes these days at a convention can be like an Etch-a-Sketch. Each one erases the day before. Has the DNC erased the email scandal and the Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepping down?
No, they have not erased it, but they perhaps have moved it down a paragraph or two in the story so that it is no longer the one thing that is on everyone's mind at the uppermost level of everyone's mind.
Yeah. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Officials in Germany are still investigating what turned a young Syrian man into a suicide bomber in the southern German town of Ansbach this past Sunday. The man had made a video pledging allegiance to the Islamic State. Authorities say the man had also attempted suicide twice in the past. He'd also been denied asylum in Germany and was expected to be deported to Bulgaria. The case is focusing attention on the question of what happens to migrants and refugees when they're in a sort of immigration limbo. Leonard Doyle is with the International Organization for Migration, and he joins us via Skype. And Leonard, clarify this for us. When an asylum seeker in a European country is denied, what happens then?
In the United States, as we know, there is one agency which deals with it. And if you are denied asylum, well, you'll probably be dealt with some rapidity, possibly incarcerated and then escorted to an airport near you at an appropriate moment. In Europe, it's not like that. You can be denied asylum and then allowed to stay in the system pending your appeals, to remain free, pending deportation issues and potentially abscond at that point to another country in Europe. And then you become kind of locked in a kind of wash and spin cycle between different European countries. There's a term for it. They call them Dublin cases, which has nothing to do with the city of Dublin, but everything to do with the treaty or the agreement that was initialed there, whereby you're meant to stay in the country where you make landfall. So if you come into Europe and you land in Greece, you're meant to stick around there until your refugee asylum case is assessed. But of course, most of them skedaddle north pretty quickly to where the jobs are and to where the families are in Germany and what have you.
So give us a sense of scale. How many migrants or refugees are in Europe right now awaiting some kind of decision on their status?
I mean, the easiest way to talk about that is the number that came into Germany, because Germany has welcomed the overwhelming number, and that's over 1 million cases last year alone. So these were entering into a system that was already kind of pretty much at breaking point. So suddenly you have a huge new influx. You can see that the pressure is enormous on the German society. And of course, many of the folks who've come in are not entitled to asylum and maybe have other agendas in mind, as we've discovered tragically over the last couple of days.
And how long can the process take before some kind of decision is made on the refugee or migrant status?
I mean, that's very much, you know, a kind of a courts issue. But there is no doubt that, for example, those coming into countries like Italy, many of them are from sub-Saharan Africa as opposed to from Syria. You know, a negative ruling seems not to matter very much. It's difficult to apprehend them, and they end up, you know, in the best case scenario, they end up living lives of exploitation. And it's really very sad because they can't work in the formal economy. So they go and work in the agricultural sector, get paid very badly, live in the shadows, live exploited, you know, in the appalling circumstances in many cases. And it sort of goes on. There's no kind of end point to it.
Do you feel that the system of dealing with refugees or migrants in Europe is working or not?
I mean, it's clearly it's in great difficulty. There's no question about it. The problem is that getting agreement amongst the political entities of Europe is very difficult. And the agreement to get the pipeline turned off earlier this year, the pipeline from Turkey into Greece, happened at enormous expense. I mean, they put down €6 billion to persuade the Turkish government to turn it off. Now, African countries are saying, well, if you could pay the Turks $6 billion, you should be able to pay us something to help in our development so that people don't have to go north and seek a better life in a not always welcoming society. So I think what's happening is that the Europeans are coming to terms with the fact that it's going to be a costly process. You're either going to have the migrants come in, or are you going to figure out a way to close the door in a way that helps societies kind of develop, create jobs, give people a reason to stay home? Because frankly, most of the refugees and migrants would probably prefer to stay home closer to their families if they could do so in safety, or if they could earn a decent living and support their families.
Well, that's Leonard Doyle. He's with the International Organization for Migration, now the UN Migration Agency, speaking to us from Geneva. Thank you so very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's Here and Now in Philadelphia. Criminal justice reform came up several times last night at the DNC. It's a passion of the Obama administration. And here's former NAACP President Benjamin Jealous.
To communities devastated by both mass incarceration and murder, join us at the ballot box, and together we will shift our nation's priorities away from the failed war on drugs and towards rehabilitation and the reincorporation of men and women returning from prison into our economy.
Well, it turns out Philadelphia is home to the most juvenile lifers, teens in prison for life, in the country. Some 300 people sentenced as kids are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. That's because for years that was a mandatory sentence in Pennsylvania for junior juveniles convicted not just of murder but also of felony murder, committing certain felonies during which a death occurs. And that's what happened to Robert Holbrook.
Nice to meet you, too.
This is Robert's sister, Anita Colon. We visited her in her lovely home outside Philly, where she showed us pictures of her younger brother.
This is in first grade, and that's his first Holy Communion. And this is my mom, and that's him with my mom. And
in 1990, on Robert's 16th birthday, some older men, drug dealers, offered him $500 to be the lookout on what was supposed to be a drug deal. But the wife of a rival drug dealer was killed, and even though Robert didn't witness it, under Pennsylvania law, he got life. For the last 26 years, all the family pictures are during prison visits.
My youngest daughter, Nadia, who, to give some perspective, is 20 now. He's been in prison for her entire life, and she's about, was almost three there on a visit that we were, you know, visiting, and...
But now several recent court decisions mean that Robert will get a chance at resentencing. We sat down to ask Anita about the potential of resentencing, but also about that day 26 years ago when her brother was sentenced.
Yeah, I remember it very, very well. Even though, I mean, I'm sure at some point we were told that there was a possibility that he could be given this sentence, I remember, you know, the shock and... just the devastation. My stepfather kept asking the attorney, well, life, all right, well, what does that mean? How many years? And I can still remember it. And he was just like, you know, it's life. And he's like, yeah, but how many years? 25, 20? Because a life sentence, you know, was not your natural life and still is not in many of our neighboring states. And so he just couldn't grasp that this was his entire life. That can't possibly be so. Like, he's a little kid. Like, how can that be?
Yeah. 26 years. You're, and your mother, when she was alive, and your family, you've all got this invisible line to your brother. What's it been like to have a sibling in prison?
Life has never, ever been the same. Even, you know, 26 years later, it's not the same. In the early years, or, you know, the years when my mom was still here, everything, every day, every occasion was always shadowed by the fact that her son was in prison and probably for the rest of his life. You're thinking about how you wish Robert was here, and so it's sadness and it's guilt, and so much guilt that, you know, what could you, should you have done more? Like, should I have, like, locked him in his room, should I've told my mother, lock him in the basement. Like, you know, you absolutely go through that. And as I watched my mom suffer and the sadness and just try to, you know, appeal to legislators, to human rights groups, there really was no one advocating about, you know, this issue. It wasn't, you know, considered an issue. And I supported my brother and knew this was a really horrible thing that happened, but it wasn't until years later that I kind of realized that this wasn't just some anomaly, that this was something that was happening, you know, all over this country. So then, you know, I became an activist, and at the same time, I had a son that was growing up. And when my son turned 16 years old, it was a really emotional day, you know, as happy as I was for him. It was just thinking, I'm sorry,
it's okay.
Thinking about looking at him, and it was just a reminder again that, you know, he was just this child. And it was like that my brother had, you know, at the age of 16, had gone to prison, an adult prison. And it tore me apart. And at the same time, there would be this relief every birthday, every thing that my son did. You know, my son got his first driver's license, and it was a happy day. And I think about that my brother never had an opportunity to get a driver's license, you know. And he went to the prom, and I'd feel so sad that he hadn't gotten to go to a prom. We go to visit him, even after all these years, when it's time to leave, and, you know, he's got to go back out one door, and we're going out another. I have to go to the ladies' room, and if I'm with my kids and I don't want them to be upset or myself, or I sit in my car and I cry. My mother wrote to my brother literally every day from the time he was incarcerated until she no longer could, like months before her death.
I'm hearing that you feel an obligation almost for your mother to keep up your connection.
Absolutely.
With him.
I mean, I love my brother, so without a doubt, I wouldn't have forgotten about him. However, I promised my mother on her deathbed, and that's, you know, not to be dramatic, it's very true, that he would never be forgotten, that we would visit him, we would write to him, that he would know his family, and that I would fight and do whatever I could to bring him home. And those were the two things I promised her.
We should note here that during our entire conversation, Anita wipes away tears almost by habit. Well, we come to the recent court decisions. In 2012, in Miller v. Alabama, the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole for juveniles is unconstitutional. Many states fought making that decision retroactive. Then this year, in Montgomery v. Louisiana, the Supreme Court ruled again, this time that its 2012 decision was retroactive, and now Robert is eligible for resentencing. Do you find yourself thinking, oh my, this could, one of the possibilities is he could come home?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is something that has been sort of like a roller coaster, because when the Miller decision came out, I cried, you know, just tears of relief and joy. And I remember calling my oldest daughter to tell her, and I was happy, but, you know, when she answered the phone, I couldn't talk. Because I was just, you know, so emotional. And she could hear I was crying. And I was trying to get the words out. And she's like, what's wrong, Mom? What's wrong? And I was like, nothing. It's not bad. It's good, you know? It was just like, finally, you know, finally. We've been fighting for so long. And then, not long after, Pennsylvania decided it wasn't retroactive. And it was just devastating.
What would you say to people who say, look, I don't care if he's 16, if somebody offers you $500 to do something that you know is wrong, mm-hmm. you know, there's a law that says that even if you're tangentially involved and there's a murder, drug handoffs and drug disputes often end in murders, you should have known. I can hear people saying this, that this is the consequences.
So what I would say, first of all, is that you can't in any way compare what an adult should have known to a child. And that is the basis of all these Supreme Court decisions, that kids are different. we spend so much time as a society and we're so concerned with how to protect children because we know they can't make decisions for themselves in every other aspect other than if they commit a crime. So all these ways, and, you know, joining the military, to get married, all of these things, we protect our youth and say, you're not mature enough to make this decision, you know, or to do this. So we need to take care of you.
Well, the other thing, again, to underscore, we've been talking about his age and the impact on your family, but he did not commit the murder.
Absolutely. I mean, my brother, without a doubt, deserved to be punished for what he did. Obviously, when there's a case, especially if there's a homicide or a death, you know, and there's a victim, the victim's family suffers and everyone, you know, realizes that. And I don't take away from that at all, you know, the suffering. Had there not been a death, had it been a drug deal and the cops would have swooped in, he would have been guilty of being involved in that. So at no point do we feel as if he should have just been able to walk away. But to take away his life, to tell him that at the age of 16, you know, when he hasn't even been able to finish high school, hasn't done anything, to say your life is worthless at this point and there is nothing you can offer society, is completely unjust and unfair.
Anita Colon talking about her brother Robert Holbrook, who was sentenced when he was 16 to life without the possibility of parole for being the lookout on a drug deal in which a murder was committed by others, a law which was in essence struck down by Supreme Court decisions. We'll follow this story to see what happens, and we welcome your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
French President François Hollande said today that the French people, quote, must realize that the terrorists will not give up until we stop them. He made the remarks after an 85-year-old French priest was killed inside a church this morning in an apparent terror attack. French authorities blamed ISIS for this latest attack, and terrorism is, of course, affecting daily life in Europe and the continent's appeal to tourists. I spoke earlier with Giselle Laborde-Sanchez with MENA Tours and Travel in Chicago, and I asked her if she has customers who are rethinking their European travel plans.
I've had some that had concerns about traveling to Europe, but we've had quite a bit of people traveling to Europe over the last couple of years.
I see. So I was looking at, for example, the State Department's travel alerts and advisories that they put out for U.S. citizens. And there isn't actually a country-specific one recently for, you know, places like France. But back in May, at the end of May, they did sort of give a European-wide travel alert, just telling Americans to be vigilant about traveling in Europe because of heightened concerns over terrorism. When people come to you and talk about where they want to visit and why, are there particular European countries that they're talking about?
Yes. There are some places that they mention, like France or Paris is one place that they would not like to travel to. There is also Belgium that's dropped off a little bit. But Spain, Italy, Greece is very much picked up in the last year.
It's interesting because obviously tourism is a huge industry in places like France. Are some of these travel groups within the countries offering special deals to keep people coming?
Yes. And that is one of the reasons that travel has picked up, because this year airfare has been probably 30, in some cases 40% lower than it normally is during this time of year,
wow,
which is high season.
So significantly discounted airfares for some places. And anything else on tours or package deals?
Well, there are some destinations that during this time are very difficult to get hotels. And if you find them, they're at a really high premium cost. This year, finding hotel availability is not a challenge. It's been easy. So it's made our job a little bit better, where we can get better price points for clients.
Now, what about travel insurance. People are recommended to get it, but in the case of, for example, a terrorist attack, would travel insurance cover a person?
It depends on the policy. There are some policy that will cover a terrorist attack in the city that they're arriving to within a certain number of days. So that is a good thing to have. Sometimes if they are in said city and need to get out, if the policy does cover for attacks of terrorism, they will be able to get assistance in leaving that city.
Finally, Giselle, I'm wondering, if someone came to you and said, hey, look, I really want to have this grand European tour, but I'm feeling a great deal of concern because of terrorism or terrorism-linked events that have been happening in Europe. I mean, what would you tell them? How would you advise them as a travel agent?
So we try to follow the warnings from the U.S. government and the State Department. We advise them, and then ultimately it's the client's decision to go. You know, we kind of see how tense they are and how well-traveled they are and how they feel about the travel. And again, we never try to pressure anybody to go anywhere, but we try to give them the information so they make a correct decision.
Well, Giselle Laborde-Sanchez is a travel consultant for MENA Tours and Travel in Chicago. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Donald Trump spoke to a gathering of the veterans of foreign wars today in Charlotte, North Carolina. He said that Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email server put Americans at risk. Clinton addressed the same group yesterday, telling them the country should not retreat behind an imaginary wall. The backdrop of their speeches to veterans is the ongoing war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the fight against the Taliban in Afghanistan, and, of course, troops returning home from all conflicts. Tom Porter is legislative director for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the largest organization representing vets of those conflicts. His group wants more from the candidates than thank you for your service.
Service members today are proving that they're more than willing to go when asked and when needed by their country. But if we're going to send more boots on ground, we need to make sure that we follow up and do justice to those service members when they return.
It's a critical need. And as Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports here in Philly, today's vets often have to turn to local programs to get the help they need.
There are more than 2.5 million veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A handful of them live here, in Philadelphia, in an old boarding house called the Veterans Group. Jose Martinez is the executive director.
The Veterans Group was established in 2007 to provide housing and case management and post-traumatic stress disorder therapy to homeless veterans in the city of Philadelphia.
Until recently, that included 34-year-old Michael de Blasio. He's a retired Marine Lance Corporal who saw heavy combat during two tours in Iraq.
You know, a lot of IEDs over there. Seen a lot of guys die. I had a lot of good friends I watched die. Firefights, stuff like that.
De Blasio now occupies one of the 41 beds in the Veterans Group house. And there was a time when the man who's in charge here, Jose Martinez, needed a bed and a shelter too.
When I moved to Philadelphia, I actually struggled with homelessness as well when I moved here because I was a student at Drexel University and there was no housing plan for a veteran student. So for 3 days, I literally was like on the street trying to figure out where I was going to live.
Martinez retired as a sergeant first class after spending more than 20 years in the Army and the Army Reserve. Originally from Camden, New Jersey, he went back to school when he left the service. But first he had to convince a landlord to waive his security deposit just so he could get an apartment.
I fell in love with the city. I fell in love with the people here, fell in love with the veteran population. We have a huge veteran population in the state of Pennsylvania. A majority of that population is the plus 55-year-old category, but nonetheless, those guys really need a lot of the services.
Homelessness and suicide remain the biggest challenge for post-9/11 veterans. Martinez says that's why the Veterans Home also offers counseling services. He has two psychiatrists who volunteer their time here.
The main focus is post-traumatic stress disorder because a lot of these guys are dealing with some type of trauma. Some of it has to do with combat, but these guys are all dealing with some type of trauma.
The Veterans Group is a nonprofit. Most of the funding comes from private donors. There's no money from the Veterans Administration, but the local VA hospital does refer veterans to this location. That's how Michael de Blasio got here.
I was in the psych ward at the VA hospital, and the social worker told me about it.
De Blasio came home from Iraq with PTSD. He's also struggled with substance abuse issues. Today, the Veterans Group is helping him, and he's hoping to go back to school for the first time in many years to return the favor.
Something I just want to give back, maybe, you know, psychology or something like that, and so I could work in the field, help other people, you know, having problems with drugs or other veterans, you know, problems with PTSD, something like that.
My name is Vincent Brennan. I'm 22 years old from South Jersey. I was in the United States Navy, and I got out E3.
Like de Blasio, this young man struggled when he left the service. He also has PTSD and was addicted to heroin. But he, too, is trying to turn his life around. He's using the GI Bill to go back to school. And Brennan is urging other veterans to ignore the stigma attached to asking for help.
I had mental problems when I got out of the service, and because I didn't follow up or get help, it led to me abusing drugs. And you don't want that to happen. You want to get help before that. But there's absolutely no problem at all with asking people for help.
Brennan and de Blasio say they are indebted to Jose Martinez, who's helping them navigate the VA benefits system.
You find there's a regulation for everything. So it's kind of like the double-edged sword, because people don't know what those regulations are, so they don't know how to navigate it. But once you learn what those regulations are, you can pretty easily navigate it. You know?
You're like Radar O'Reilly on MASH.
Pretty much, yeah, for veterans. I see a lot of veterans here who are not even residents of our house. They just get my name through networking, and I get a call. At least if you look in my binder, you'll see 3-4 veterans I see a week.
The presidential race doesn't resonate at the Veterans Group home. Martinez says veterans often feel exploited by candidates.
I haven't heard anyone really talk about what the real issues are. I think from my experience, everyone wants to support veterans now until it's time to support veterans.
And support is what the Veterans Group provides. It certainly helped Vietnam vet Thomas Glacklin. He's 65. He's been homeless off and on for many years, but now he has a bed and a roof over his head.
This place saved my life, really.
For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock in Philadelphia.
Some terrific reporting there from outside the DNC in Philadelphia. And as Alex and Robin and everyone in Philly can attest, it's really hot there and hot across much of the country. So maybe you're enjoying the heat and still are in full summer vacation mode. But let's face it, and maybe parents are happy about this, it's not long until the school year starts, and retailers are saying that they expect strong back-to-school sales. Last week, the National Retail Federation predicted soaring sales, with families snapping up backpacks and crayons, but also computers and other tech items. And then today, the Retailers Trade Group upped its estimate for the entire year's sales. Well, Marilyn Gwax is NPR Senior Business Editor. She's been following this, and she joins us now. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Meghna.
So it's still July. We're talking about back-to-school shopping already?
Yes, time to put away the flip-flops, the sunscreen, and think about back to school. And the trade group says that that's exactly what a lot of Americans are actually doing. They're spending earlier than they usually do. The group predicts that consumers are going to spend nearly $76 billion on school-related items, and that's up almost $8 billion from last year. So that's a huge jump.
Wow.
People are going to be spending more freely on things like shoes and notebooks and backpacks. But the college students, they're the big ticket ones. They're the ones that are expensive. They want new laptops, mini fridges for dorm rooms, and they're getting them. And, remember that in the past year, consumer inflation is up only about 1%. So these increases in revenues for retailers, they're really very significant.
Very significant. I'm going to sound like a curmudgeon here, but back in my day, we didn't have flat screen TVs in my dorm.
Popcorn maker if we were lucky.
So what's going on? What's driving this?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just that cheap gas. AAA says that the average gallon of regular gas is $2.15. Last summer, you were paying $2.71. Mm-hmm. But if you think back in the summer of 2008, we were paying more than $4 a gallon. So that price crush was hitting just when people were losing jobs. Remember, that was when the recession was really just starting to take hold. So this summer, we flipped the script. This year, gas is cheap, and that's happening just when unemployment is down to 4.9%. And also, hourly wages have finally been ticking up a bit. They're up 2.6% from a year ago. So people are feeling fairly confident about their jobs, and they have more cash to spend. So if you, you know, save $20 at the gas pump this week compared with last summer, you've got a 20 in your wallet. I looked up the prices. You can buy a Superman backpack and an insulated lunch bag for that $20.
Good deal. But those cheaper gas prices aren't the only thing, really, are they?
No, there's a couple other factors. One thing is cheap credit. You know, interest rates have been quite low, so a lot of credit cards are cheaper than they were a few years ago. And even a few of the fees are cheaper this year. And here's another thing that's happening is mortgage refinancings. You know, and mortgage rates have got so low this year that people have finally switched out those expensive mortgage payments for cheaper ones. They might be saving a couple $100 a month now because of that. And there's one other thing that you wouldn't even like necessarily think of, but the strong dollar is helping. A lot of the back-to-school stuff that we buy is made overseas. Uh-huh. So if you have a strong dollar and you're a retailer and you go to buy those backpacks made in China or a shirt made in Bangladesh, it's actually pretty cheap, and you can pass those savings along to consumers. So it's a great summer for consumers.
Marilyn Giwax is NPR's senior business editor. Marilyn, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome.
Australian Leon Moriarty is best known in the United States for her novels The Husband's Secret and Big Little Lies. Both books center around a group of women with secrets in their pasts and the events that thrust those secrets out into the open. And both books topped bestseller lists here in the U.S. Now, Leon Moriarty fans have a new novel to savor, Truly Madly Guilty, out today. It's about friendships that are forever changed after a disastrous neighborhood barbecue. And Leon Moriarty joins us via Skype from her home in Sydney to talk about the book and her career. Leon, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, before we talk specifically about Truly Madly Guilty, I actually just want to step back for a moment because you have published several other novels. And then The Husband's Secret came along, and that was a huge bestseller in the U.S. and internationally back in, 2013? And I just wonder, what was that moment like for you, really sort of breaking out as a global writing phenom?
Yes, it was strange because it was my fifth book. So in a way, I think that was a good thing, really. I can't quite imagine having a huge success with your first book. But the experience of breaking out, I can tell you, it tastes like maple syrup. Because when I got the call from my editor there in America that I'd hit the New York Times bestseller list, I'd just been going to a cafe with my little girl and I was going to have muesli for breakfast. But because of that news, I had French toast with maple syrup. So I can taste maple syrup whenever I hear New York Times.
So literally the sweet taste of success. I love it.
It is. That's right. Exactly.
Now, your books are set in your native Australia, but obviously they're resonating with people far away from Australia, including so many readers here in the US. Why do you think that is?
I think that they do enjoy the fact that the books are set in Australia and so that it feels a little bit exotic, but not so different that they can't relate to it. But I think it's really because I'm writing a lot about parenting, and I think that the experience of parenting is clearly universal because I'm always receiving emails from people saying, I can't believe I'm here, you know, and they name such exotic places to me all around the world. And as a school parent, for example, my experiences are exactly the same.
Mm. So speaking of that, let's talk specifically about the new book, about Truly Madly Guilty. The heart of the book is an incident at a neighborhood barbecue. It's basically every parent's nightmare. Can you just give us a little hint as to what happens?
Yes,
in the book?
Basically, it's about something that happens at a barbecue, and I was inspired by something that happened to me when I was at a barbecue with some friends, and it just stayed with me for months afterwards, and that became the inspiration.
I'm wondering if part of the reason why you write so much about particularly the challenges and these dangers, is it a way for you to exercise your own fears?
to work through it, perhaps without making a conscious decision to do that. But also, I think I tend to write about what's preoccupying me. But yes, in this one, I definitely explore that constant, almost permanent state of terror that you feel as a parent.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, in the book that followed The Husband's Secret, Big Little Lies, that's actually now becoming an HBO series with Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman, right?
It is. Apparently it's a wrap. They've finished filming, so they've had their wrap party and they're editing it at the moment, and it will be on screens early next year.
I'm always curious about how writers feel when their stories make the jump from the pages of a book into television or the big screen. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm excited. I don't know exactly how I'm going to feel when I see the finished product, but what I've seen so far, I've just loved the whole process. So I got to visit the set back in April. I happened to be there when they were filming a really key scene from the book, and I got to see Nicole Kidman dressed up exactly as I described it in the book, and I was really surprised that I got quite emotional seeing her, because she just seemed like something out of a fairy tale, because she looked so exquisite, and it was just a real thrill, really, to see a whole world that I'd created in my mind brought to life.
Well, one last question for you. I mean, you've had multiple bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list. And we were reading a review of Big Little Lies, and it was a New York Times review. And it was interesting because there was a passage in the review that described your writing as, quote, gossipy and referred to your easy girlfriendy style.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what you make of that.
I don't know. I find it really hard to respond to reviews because I find it really hard to be objective about my own writing. But yeah, it's a bit of an issue with the way perhaps a book written by a woman is reviewed. Perhaps if it had been a male author, or not perhaps, I know if it had been a male author, it would not have been described as a girl-friendly style.
Leon Moriarty's latest book is Truly Madly Guilty. She spoke with us today via Skype from her home in Sydney. Leon, thank you so very much.
Oh, that's my absolute pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. I like your girlfriend style. It's Here and Now.